Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Nashville Lawyers Chapter of Federalist Society sponsored public policy debate. I'm Joseph Woodruff from Long & Lanson Law Firm. Let me first begin by expressing our gratitude and thanks to the law firm of Bold Cummings, Connors & Berry for hosting today's event. And I especially want to single out and thank Russ Morgan and Janet Sumi of the Bold Cummings firm for all their hard work in making today's event possible. By way of administrative matters, I'm sure you've all found refreshments that are in the lobby. If you need a comfort moment, please step through the doors at the rear of the room, cross the lobby, through the next set of doors, through a single door into a blue room, and then you'll be out on the street. And the facilities will be back by the blue room. Again, we express our gratitude to Bold Cummings for making this fabulous facility available to us for this event today. We're very privileged to have two very distinguished advocates to participate in today's debate on the subject of whether judicial elections are good public policy or not. We have with us from the Alabama Supreme Court, Associate Justice Harold C., and linked up the Attorney General's Office and the Court of Criminal Appeals and other judicial positions, which I will detail more in just a moment, General Paul Summers as our advocates. In Alabama, Democratic and Republican candidates, and sometimes other third-party candidates, compete in contested partisan elections. During Alabama's last election cycle in 2006, Alabama voters elected a Democrat, Chief Justice Sue Bell Cobb, while Republicans secured the other seats that were on the court. Justice C. would likely concede that Alabama's system for choosing judges is not perfect. But he would, I assume, note that it is open to the public and facilitates judicial accountability. In addition, Alabama's system of seating judges comports with its state constitution, which states that Alabama's appellate judges, quote, shall be elected by the qualified electors. Alabama holds contested judicial elections. Tennessee's constitution uses almost identical language, stating that judges of the Supreme Court shall be elected by the qualified voters of the state. However, Tennessee does not hold traditional contested elections. The plain language of both constitutions is perhaps a sufficient basis alone for supporting judicial elections. But instead, Tennessee has adopted its own system of judicial appointment known as the Tennessee Plan. As the General Assembly considers whether to allow that plan to sunset this year, we at the National Chapter of the Federalist Society believe it is an important time to consider whether contested judicial elections would be a good method for seating appellate judges and whether it is good public policy to have contested judicial elections and all the trappings that come with it. Our two guests are uniquely qualified to opine on this issue. Justice C. was elected to the Alabama Supreme Court in 1996 and re-elected in 2002. Prior to joining the court, he was a law professor at the University of Alabama for more than 20 years. He is an avid advocate for and supporter of contested judicial elections and often speaks around the country on this issue. Justice C. has run and lost, he has run and won, and he's run for re-election and won. No doubt, I suspect that he would agree that winning is better than losing.
Yeah, but mainly you just want it over.
General Paul Summers served Tennessee as its Attorney General from 1999 to 2006. He's also served as a judge on the Tennessee Court of Criminal Appeals, having been appointed to the bench by Governor McWhorter in 1990 and retained through retention elections in 1992 and 1998. He's currently my law partner, Law & Lanson Dorsey Davis. General Summers has been elected by the voters of a judicial district as a circuit judge. He has been appointed He has been evaluated and retained in accordance with the yes-no procedure of the Tennessee merit plan. And he has been appointed to a judicial office as Attorney General by the Supreme Court. Just about every way you can be appointed to a judicial or achieve a judicial office in the state of Tennessee, General Summers has experience. A word about our format. Each advocate will be given 10 minutes to make an opening statement. Then they will have 5 minutes each to cross-examine the other. This will be followed by questions from the audience that will be submitted in writing. And you'll notice at the end of your row there are note cards. So if you have any questions that occur to you during the course of the advocate's opening statements or their own cross-examination of each other, please write them down on the card and give them to Jeff. Otherwise, give them up to me, and I'll comb through them and we'll ask the questions from the audience. Following the audience questions, each advocate will be given a closing statement. By prior arrangement, General Summers, who is an opponent of judicial elections and believes that contested elections on a partisan basis of appellate judges is bad public policy, will go first. General Summers?
Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. First, thank you very much for inviting me to be on this debate with Justice C. It's been a great pleasure for me to actually meet him, to have lunch with him. I've been talking with various of my partners about Justice C. He is a true gentleman, and it's my pleasure to be here with you today. Thank you, Woody, and thank you, Emma, for inviting me, and thank everybody for coming. The good news is that we're going to be discussing a policy today and opinions on a policy. The bad news, Mac, is we're not going to debate the Tennessee plan. It's this constitutionality. And I'm sure that with John Jay and Mac in the room, it's going to come up. But that is history as far as I'm concerned, especially since Magistrate Jeff Brown was in the back, and I think he wrote the latest opinion on that subject. But at any rate, my position as to be asked to be on this particular panel is, what is my position as to whether or not judges should be elected or whether they should be in some other type of selection process? Let's break it down first as to how judges get their jobs in America. And I'm specifically talking about state courts. You have two basic types of elections. You've got what we consider to be partisan elections, where R's run against D's or run against I's. And then you've got nonpartisan elections, primarily independent candidates. So that's your election type of category. Now, everything else probably includes the following permutation or combination. In some states, the governor appoints, and that person's appointee is confirmed by the legislature. Or in some states, the governor appoints, and his or her appointment is later elected. In some states, the judges are elected by the legislature of that particular state. In some states, you have a retention plan, such as the one that was envisioned by Missouri several years ago and adopted by Tennessee circa 1971. And then in some states like Tennessee, you have a combination of a merit selection retention plan. 39 states elect some or all of their judges at what we consider to be a, quote, popular election, unquote. Of course, we know what the federal system is like, and that is the president appoints, and then it's the appointee is confirmed by the Senate. How does Tennessee select its judicial? I'm sure this is ancient history for some of you, but just kind of an overview. Primarily, in your 31 judicial districts, your trial judges, and in the counties, your general sessions judges, are elected in some type of popular election in either their county or, in case of the circuit judge, chancellor, criminal court judge, in that particular person's district. they are elected for an 8-year term. Sometimes they run in partisan elections, depending on the district. Sometimes they run in nonpartisan elections, all of them running as independents. If a vacancy occurs on a trial bench, then after the Judicial Selection Commission recommends 3 names to the governor selects that vacancy, selects a person to fill in that vacancy, and then he or she serves until the next biennial election in August. That's the trial judge. Appellate judges are a little bit different. Appellate judges run on the Tennessee plan, also commonly called the Modified Missouri plan. Appellate judges, whether they be Supreme Court, Court of Criminal Appeals, or Court of Appeals, they run on truly a merit selection plan. You have two commissions. Number one, a Judicial Selection Commission, which is composed of selectees by the Speaker of the House and the Speaker of the Senate, after various groups like Tennessee Trial Lawyers, the Tennessee Bar Association, the Public Defenders, and District Attorneys make recommendations as to who should be on the Selection Commission. The Selection Commission then selects someone, a list of 3, to submit to the governor, and from that list, the governor makes a selection. Now, before the next biennial August election in Tennessee, that person then must go before another commission called the Judicial Evaluation Commission, consisting, if I recall correctly, of 14 or 15 people who are selected by the same selectors, and these, the Judicial Evaluation Commission, which consists of not only lawyers, but also laymen and judges, makes recommendations as to whether or not that person should be retained or whether that person should not be retained by a vote. I think there are 12 on that commission. They have to have a vote of 6, have to vote of 7. Judge Wiedemeyer, for example, on the Court of Criminal Appeals, before he can run at the next election, he's got to get 7 votes on the Judicial Evaluation Commission. If a judge does not get the evaluation, then it becomes an open, partisan election, just like in the old days. Now, let's notice, how did we have it before the selection commission process? In Tennessee, back before the Tennessee plan came into effect, the voters of Tennessee, we had a partisan, or if you wanted to run as an independent, a nonpartisan election in Tennessee for the Supreme Court, for the Court of Criminal Appeals, and for the Court of Appeals. In 1971, the Missouri plan came into effect. However, when Winfield Dunn was governor 3 years later, the Democrats decided that there might be a possibility that he would appoint too many Republicans, so they took the Supreme Court out of it. And then the Supreme Court stayed out of the Tennessee plan until 1994 when it was put back in. But when we were electing people popular, it took 34 votes to become a justice on the Supreme Court. How did that work? I'll tell you how it worked. Back before the Tennessee plan, Republicans just couldn't win. Not true today, but Republicans were just completely in the dark, in the cold, so far as being elected to the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, or the Court of Criminal Appeals. In January, before the election, the Democratic Executive Committee would meet in caucus over in the House chambers, and the 66 members of the Democratic Executive Committee would decide who was going to be on the list of 5 for the Supreme Court, or on the list of 9 at that time for the Court of Criminal Appeals, or on the list of 9 at that time for the Court of Appeals. And whoever the Democratic Executive Committee decided would be on that slate would be the next Supreme Court justice. Sometimes the Republicans wouldn't even field a slate of 5 because they knew that it was a fait accompli. They weren't going to get elected. Not true today. The Tennessee plan primarily was devised to at that time to help the minority party, the Republicans, get some members on the appellate court. That's what happened. But when they talk about, well, we used to have partisan elections in Tennessee. We ought to elect the Supreme Court. It was partisan in the sense that if you had 34 votes, you were going to be on the Tennessee Supreme Court. Reasons to elect. Reasons not to elect. Reasons to elect, ladies and gentlemen. Number one, people have a say. Next, people can contribute and people can politic and they can put up polls on. Next, it allows any lawyer to be a judge if he or she can get 25 signatures on a ballot by people in the state of Tennessee. Next, it promotes judicial restraint. Next, 39 states elect some or all of the judges, so they must be right. Next, maybe it's okay for trial courts, or if it's okay for trial courts, then it ought to be okay for appellate courts. Reasons not to elect. Number one, removes politics. Number two, removes partisanship. Number three, removes racial bias. Number four, removes gender bias. Number five, more even-handed justice. Number six, don't have to rely on the Democratic or the Republican Executive Committee. Number seven, judges are not bought and paid for, or at least the perception is that they're not bought and paid for. Number eight, special interest groups aren't all that influential like they used to be with the trial lawyers, the Tennessee Education Association and Labor. We don't have a pay-to-play justice system to elect. And finally, the screening gets better and the quality gets better than having to get 25 names on a petition to run for election. Those are the reasons not to elect. I think my time's up.
It's working now. Okay. And if it is too loud, let me know. I'll farther away. Okay. A number of years ago, I was reading a short story, and the narrator speaking of the main character, he was a variation of the H.L. Mencken said. I like his version better, though. This short story last year. He said, of the person, the character, a moment's thought would have made this obvious. But a moment is a long time, and thought is a good process. I'd ask that we take a moment's thought about some of these considerations. Let me say, first of all, there's no perfect system. My father used to tell me, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. You know, don't, because you find something is imperfect, reject it. And what we ought to do, the moment thought makes this obvious to us, is to compare. Are there problems? You know, what we normally hear, and let me say we didn't hear it put quite this way today, what we normally hear is that elections are expensive and they're nasty. Therefore, we should have merit selection. It seems to me there's something missing in that analysis. Yeah, okay, so they're nasty, so they're expensive, but what about the alternative? Is the alternative better or worse? I'm here advocating for the elected process. I certainly don't consider it to be a perfect system. We heard this comment. Why should we have a Tennessee plan instead of elections? Why? Well, the statement is because we'll get better quality, right? Unfortunately, The social science research does not support that. Melissa, I'm trying to remember her name now, Melinda, I think it is, Gann Hall, was written extensively in this area, wrote in the Journal of Political Science in 1992. Empirical research on the effects of judicial selection processes has been quite consistent in finding that methods of judicial recruitment do not affect either the quality of the bench or judicial outcomes. Likewise, studies demonstrate selection methods do not affect the tendency for state Supreme Courts to rule in favor of particular categories of litigants. Based on the evidence today, the conclusion reasonably could be drawn that selection mechanisms simply do not have much of an impact on the operation of state judiciaries. Now, it'd be nice, from the standpoint of elections, if I could say, well, look, they're higher quality. No, it's just we don't see much difference. You look at the best of the ability of the social sciences, when you look, you find they're roughly the same. Don't see any noticeable difference in quality. How about this expense and tone? Gosh, it's so easy, all these expensive elections, and there are ugly things being said, therefore. Well, now, let's see. Therefore, this is the Tennessee plan, the Missouri plan, the so-called merit selection. And I'd urge you to take a moment's thought about words like merit selection and partisan election and what they really mean. We have an appointive system in the federal government. So let's think about that. Let's see. They don't have ugly appointment process, right? Clarence Thomas says high elevated discussion of who would be the best justice. They don't spend money, right? The confirmation of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito, non-controversial, if you remember, they spent $15 million. Let me ask this question. Why? Why are they spending this money? Because judges have a great deal of influence in our country. And because there are interests that are concerned about how judges are going to decide. Because they have that concern, they're willing to invest money. Now, stop and think about it. Let's suppose somebody's willing to invest $1 million in the election of a judge. Why? It's worth $1 million. Now suppose, instead, you have an appointed system. Is it suddenly not worth $1 million? It's worth the same thing, isn't it? It's just a question of where you put the money. The only reason we know about the Alito and Roberts money is because they spent it on television, mailings, and things of that sort, where we could see it. If it's a commission, it's still worth $1 million, to get the right people on the commission deciding the right way to select the right people. It's just you can't see it. The nastiness. You hear nasty comments made about people in elections because it's the voters who decide they're the ones you got to convince. If it's an appointed process, you think they're not going to say ugly things? They're just going to say them behind closed doors. They're going to say them to the decision makers. And the person about whom they're being said is going to know. Is going to have a chance to respond. At least in an election, you can get out there and say, this isn't true. The appointed process, you may never know. Gosh, I wonder why they didn't pick it. Probably never find out. Let's see here. Independence and legitimacy. We want our judges to be independent. But we don't want them to be independent of the law, do we? The idea in our tripartite system of government is that we want a separation of powers. We want that so that all power doesn't concentrate in a single set of hands in order to protect our freedom. That's why we want the separation of powers. So we want an independent judiciary. What gives us the best chance at an independent judiciary? To have a legislature, which is by far the most powerful branch, so look at your British history. The legislature being the ones who have the input into who the judges are and whether the judges get to set. The governor, a member of the executive branch. Or is it better to have an independent base for judges as they're elected by the public? In the initial days of our country, virtually every state, well, Vermont was the exception. Vermont had elected judges. Everybody else followed the federal system. appointed judges. Lawyers who were concerned about reform, you know, were troubled by the politics that was going on, the backroom dealings, and the way that that they perceived judges were in the pockets of governors and legislators. And they went to an elective system. Why? Because they thought it was better to have judges answerable to the people than answerable to one of the two branches. And that's consistent with the two branches. That's consistent with our notions of a separation of powers, to have judges elected. Now, there are some objections to that, of course. The criticism is that, well, they don't even know who their judges are. This is the way you usually hear it. Is stop some people on the street and ask them who's on their Supreme Court. I'll bet you they can't tell you. Alright, therefore, we should have a system with a commission that nominates three to the governor, and the governor picks one of those three. Stop those same people and ask them, who's your state representative? Who's your state senator? Maybe we should have a commission of lawyers to select three names to submit to the governor to appoint a state representative, the state senator. Well, of course, the fact is, yeah, there are lots of folks, there are lots of officials that people on the street, you stop on a given day, can't identify. But that doesn't mean that democracy doesn't work. Ask them about the person they understand is not performing the job right. In general, incumbents get reelected. If everything's going fine, people vote for it. But when they hear something wrong about someone, when they believe that there's someone who's not performing the job the way he's supposed to be performing the job, they know who to vote against. What contested elections do is provide that information. There's someone with an incentive to get out there and say, look, you know, this guy's not doing right. You know, this judge isn't acting like a judge. You know, in some other area, not acting like a legislator or a governor or whatever it is. There is someone with incentive to do that. Now, of course, under the Tennessee plan, there's no incentive to do that, not because there's no opponent. I mean, first of all, there's an appointment, and when the election takes place, there's no opponent. And even if somebody wanted to get rid of it, what are they going to get? In other words, it's like it. Huh? You don't have a choice. You could vote against someone and have the same people that gave you that one give you another one. Let's see. I think there's okay. Well, let me make a major point. Let me make the next related point. The other question is, are voters really smart enough to elect judges? Or do they not understand the judicial role, and therefore they ought not be exercising this judgment? Well, I think they do. I mean, out there, it seems to me what their view is. The judges ought to apply the law. Huh? Legislators ought to make it. Judges ought to apply the law. That's what the Constitution calls for. Seems to me they understand. I mean, it takes a legal education, doesn't it, to get any other view about what judges ought to do. There is, though, today, a dispute over judicial philosophy. Okay? There are those who believe judges ought to do what's right, regardless of the law, judicial activism, conservative or liberal. There are those who believe judges ought to do what the law requires. I think that's a constitutional question. And if it is a constitutional question, as the judges should be a separate branch of government performing a judicial function. If it's a constitutional question, I think the people ought to have the right to choose. People ought to have a right to exercise judgment as to whether these judges are doing what they're supposed to be doing or not. And I don't think having information essentially proposed to lawyers is the answer that most folks out there would choose. You know, for me, it's fine. I like lawyers. I deal with lawyers. They're going to look after my interests. I'd be less satisfied if the commission were made up of realtors, I think. But it seems to me that if you believe in democracy, if you trust the voter, it makes a whole lot of sense to have the judges, have the electorate exercise their judgment as to who is performing the official function. Thank you.
General Summers, you now have 5 minutes to cross-examine
Just see, you said that under the Tennessee plan, which I'm not going to hold you to know and all that.
I don't. You may correct me. I may discover some great things this last
day. You know, there is in the retention part of the Tennessee plan, there is ample opportunity for a judge not to be retained. Two ways. Number one, they may not get out of the Judicial Evaluation Commission by a vote of 7-5. In which event there will be a contested or a nonpartisan contested race in Tennessee. That's number one. Or, if they do get out of the Judicial Selection Commission after their performance has been evaluated, then the voters might not elect them or might not retain them by a vote of 50% plus one vote. Doesn't that give the voters an opportunity to make a choice as to whether or not what their performance is good or bad?
On what information?
Well, one thing, the Judicial Evaluation Commission, which consists of 12 people, they meet about 7 months prior to first Thursday in August election every 8 years. After they evaluate, and the evaluation come from the public, come from court clerks, come from lawyers who've been in front, and come from the other judges. And then they also interview the judges and look at the judge's record and look at the way he or she's been writing their opinions and look at whether or not they've been timely. And then they come out with a report that's been produced in 5 major newspapers on a Sunday in March prior to the August election, and also puts it on the Administrative Office of the Court website. So the public has a lot more information about how an appellate judge is operating for the last 2 years or 8 years than in any other office in the state of Tennessee, including the governor, the legislature, the system. So isn't that an informed electorate when they go to the ballot box?
Well, you know, if we didn't
get it again. I get back.
Yeah. I think suppose the thing to do is stop and think. Let's suppose we did that presidential election. We said, well, we've got a commission. And the commission is going to interview the candidates and going to give you information on how they performed their previous jobs. And we're going to publish that in the leading newspapers and we're going to have it on a website. Now, isn't that enough information to elect a president? Hey, it is useful. I'm for it. I think you ought to have it. And, you know, if there were a commission doing it, I think the Bar Association ought to do it. And I think other people ought to do it as well. I think, you know, other groups ought to get together. You know, the plaintiff's bar, the Chamber of Commerce, we think those folks ought to gather this information and put it out there. And I'm all in favor of information, but is that sufficient information? Well, it's going to depend on the commission, isn't it? And you may have a fantastic commission today, you may not have a fantastic commission 10 years from now. Because there are going to be people who have interest in who's on that bench, and they're going to be investing money in making sure that the right folks are on that commission.
Your election last time you ran cost you right at $2 million.
I think a little under, yeah.
When you ran the time before, your election cost you $2.4 million.
That's right.
Your colleague, the only Democrat on the Alabama Supreme Court, is Sue Bell Cobb. And her election last year cost about $2.6 million.
I think it was a little more than that.
Are you familiar with the comment that when she was, right after she was elected Chief Justice last year, she was asked, you know, she was asking questions about her perception of the race. Are you familiar with some of her comments?
I suspect I'm familiar with virtually all of them, but I don't know which one you're
talking about. Let me ask you what you think about Chief Justice Sue Bell's comment when she said that instead of being asked, Justice, Chief Justice, how do you feel about being at least the first woman in recent times being elected Chief Justice? How do you feel about being the only Democrat? She wasn't asking you those questions. She was asked, and I want you to comment on it. She was asked and she responded. About Chief Justice, what do you think about having spent $2.6 million? And she said that, quote, I think that it's unacceptable. People need to have faith in the courts, raising large amounts of money does not give us an independent judiciary. That's your Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, your comment. What's your comment about her comment?
I think it misses a whole lot. That's a lot of money. And as I mentioned, one of the complaints that's normally raised is, well, gosh, they're expensive. You may also remember that Alito and Roberts cost a whole lot more than that. But information, getting information out, is an expensive proposition. Our governor spent $28 billion. Our legislature spent, I'm trying to remember, somewhere $25 million to be elected. It costs money to get that information out there. Would I like it to be free? Yeah. In fact, I asked a newspaper editor to complain about the money that was spent on judicial elections. I said, well, will you run our ads for free? He said, no.
Well, where did Sue Bell Cobb get most of her money? From what type of organization? Was it off the internet by $5?
Oh, no. But I don't know. I didn't look at her financials.
Where did you raise most of your money?
I had thousands of contributors. A whole lot of it was from that and others, the PAC money. I've been a defender of PAC money because you don't know who gave it.
Would you say that the bulk of your money came from clients?
No.
How about from business?
For individuals and business. Yeah.
So the trial lawyers probably know.
Well, I had donations from trial lawyers, but not a lot. I'm sure Sue Bell Cobb had a lot more donations from trial lawyers.
Sue Bell, being a Democrat, probably got most of her money from trial lawyers.
Yeah, I did not look at it. I wouldn't be at all surprised.
Now, I don't have any question about your integrity. I know you. I know people who know you. And I know you're an honorable man, you're an honest man, but don't you think that gives the impression that there's justice for Satan?
It does. It gives the impression. I think it is not a fact. I mean, I've served with Democrats who were funded by trial lawyers, and they did not vote based on who the clients were. They voted based on what the law was. So I don't know. They have different perceptions, different judicial philosophy. So I think it is not a fact, but yeah, it does create an impression. Now, I do have a problem though, because it doesn't create that impression when someone is appointed, even if all that money is there. What we're suggesting, if we say, well, because of this impression, we can't trust the public to understand what's really going on, we've got to hide from them the politics is going on. We've got to keep all this behind closed doors. We've got to have them not know what money's going into the governor's fund, for example, in order to assure that the governor will appoint the people that someone wants. We need to keep all this secret, that the strength of democracy depends upon the ignorance of the electorate. And I just can't accept that. I think it is far better to have it out in the light of day. People can look at it. They can see where I got my money. They can see where she got her money. They can and they can decide. Is this someone?
Charles, I'd like to ask the witness to answer me yes or no.
Yes or no?
I'm sorry. I would like to answer the question. In the interest of full disclosure, that Sue Bell Cobb, Justice Sue Bell Cobb, is my law school classmate. And 2 years ago, we had our 25th reunion at the University of Alabama. She was in the midst of her campaign. I only wish that she had discovered then. That raising $2.6 million is unacceptable. Well, she sure quitted everybody's arm in her class. As her classmate, I'm delighted for her. Justice C., you now have 5 minutes to subject General Summers to cross-examination. And ladies and gentlemen, if you have any questions, please submit them in writing so we can have questions from the audience when General Summers is finished being cross-examined by Justice C.
Yeah, I guess the implication in the things that you will not have if you don't have elections, the things that will be removed, is that under, presumably under Tennessee or any other land, you won't have politics. Can you explain to me how you keep politics out of the commission?
Well, you can't. It would be naive of me. I said no politics. I meant
not the kind of politics that you've got in parts of the country.
Instead of some behind-the-door politics.
Well, let me explain. You keep talking about behind-the-door politics, but I've been through both. I've been through the partisan election as a district attorney, but I've also been through the selection process. And I really don't know what you're talking about when you're talking about behind-the-door politics.
It's all out in the open.
The only thing that's not out in the open is the closed interview of the Judicial Selection Commission. The public hearings are in the open. John J. Hooker can come. Alan Smart can come. Matt Davis can come. And they can testify of what a no good, low down son of a bitch you are. And you should never be a judge. Or they can say that you are pure as driven snow, you're quintessential, and you're the best thing since sliced bread. That's all out in the open. The evaluation process is all out in the open. The evaluation process is printed in 5 newspapers in March before the election. I don't know what's closed about that.
Well, I guess what I'd be concerned about is what gets said to these folks elsewhere.
What do you mean?
Outside of the commission. They aren't talked to by folks.
You can, the commission can talk to anybody they want to. People, they have a public hearing where the people line up in a room, in a hotel room, and they have people testifying before the commission about it. You can submit letters, you can submit affidavits. They can do anything they want.
Well, let me ask you another question. We managed to do away with partisanship also. So a person's political affiliation is irrelevant in this selection process.
Yes, it is. Matter of fact, right now, back in 1990, when that Supreme Court was elected, there were 5 Democrats. Matter of fact, two good judges were replaced at that time. Now you've got 3 Republicans, maybe 2.5 Republicans. You've got 3 Republicans on the Supreme Court and 2 Democrats right now on the Tennessee Supreme Court. And since that time, we've had Republican governors and Democratic governors. And some Democratic governors have appointed Republican appointees.
Well, if you know a whole lot more about Tennessee and how it operates than I do, I would find that surprising, and I would find it surprising if it continued. If in fact you do have a commission that is, that is completely open and nonpartisan and non-political and not influenced by it in any way. Let's see. Well, I have one other question, but let's get one.
I have the first question. That I have for both advocates is as follows, and please do submit your written questions. Judge Bill Pryor of the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit has written and spoken on the subject of judicial independence on a number of occasions, and he has argued that the greatest protection of judicial independence is judicial restraint. Do you agree with Judge Pryor about judicial restraint being the greatest protection of judicial independence? And if you agree or disagree, how does your agreement or disagreement inform your view on whether the election of judges is good or bad public policy?
That's a complicated question. Go ahead.
Well, I will go first. I agree with Judge Pryor. And it seems to me that the thrust of the point is the one I made all too briefly, but you know, we have a limited amount of time, that I alluded to. If judges are activist judges, if they do more, and look back in history until certainly before the 1920s, no judge would have thought of interpreting some statute to mean the opposite of what it really says. With the 1920s, we have this movement in legal education to convince people judges ought to be policymakers, and if the legislature's wrong, they ought to correct the legislature. Well, when judges become activists, when they start making policy instead of letting the legislature make policy, when judges start making policy, it becomes very valuable to have the right judge on the bench. to a number of inmates. So instead of lobbying the legislature, all they need to do is start investing in the judiciary. That creates the very problems that we've been talking about here. That's why there's a lot of money in it, because there are judges who don't act like judges, they act like legislators. And it's worth money to folks to have the right policies being made. If instead they exercised reasonable judicial restraint, that was the general practice, you wouldn't see all of that investment. It also go ahead.
Well, I'm not sure we disagree with Bill Pryor, who's a former colleague of mine, now in the appellate court. We got restful. Judge Bivens is here from Nashvilleian, but he's former from New Mexico. Now he has a unique, Judge Bivens over here has a unique standing because he has been elected in partisan races for the Court of Appeals in New Mexico, and then New Mexico changed it to judicial merit selection, and he's been retained and elected under that process, merit selection. What he told me before we got started today, he sure likes the merit selection a lot better because the last time he ran, he only spent 37 cents. 75 cents. And that was to mail two stamps to ask to be retained to, you know, they had his name on the ballot. Judicial restraint. I'm not sure if anybody really knows how to define judicial restraint. It seems like judicial restraint usually is defined by the one who loses the case. For example, the Kelo case in the United States Supreme Court in February of 2005, not a big deal. I call it Kelo, it may be pronounced Kelo, versus Township of North New Haven. The Kelo case, K-E-L-O case, involving lighted areas. Justice Stevens wrote the opinion. He basically, in a 5-4 decision, Justice Stevens said, you know, this is a judicially restrained opinion because what we're doing is we are deferring back to local government. We are deferring the decision as to what is a blighted area, whether a piece of property can be taken by inverse condemnation or eminent domain. We are relegating that back to local government. He said, and the commentator said, that's a case of judicial restraint. The four dissenting on Kelo said, that's judicial activism. That's judicial activism. They're reading something into the Constitution that's not there. So I'm not so sure what is judicial restraint. The only thing I've ever been able to see is that when you don't like the decision, you say, well, we've got an activist court. But if you like the decision, you say, well, they just interpret the Constitution properly.
Yeah, and a lot of people do say that, but it seems to me, you know, just to tie your mind to it, you've seen judicial activism, you've seen judicial restraint. You've seen judges who applied the law, whether they agreed with it or not, and you've seen judges who changed the law because they didn't like it. And on the issue of which a judge likes better, the day after I was elected, a newspaper reporter asked me, he said, after all you've been through, wouldn't you rather have been appointed? And I said, yeah, and for life. But that's not the question. The question isn't what would a judge like. I can tell you lots of things. I'd like be good for me. It's not supposed to be about us. It's supposed to be about the people. And it seems to me the people ought to have a right to hold us to their Constitution. And if we start acting contrary to the Constitution, I'll be able to get rid of it.
Let me say one more thing. In the judiciary, I mean, you know, we all know that the legislative branch is supposed to express the views of the majority. So the executive branch, John Jay, is supposed to express the views of the majority. Isn't the judiciary supposed to be there to protect the views of the minority when the majority is wrong? If it wasn't for that, then we wouldn't have Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka to overrule Plessy versus Ferguson. We wouldn't have that. If we did not have the judiciary protecting the minority, against the majority when the majority is flat wrong.
Thank you. I have some questions from the audience, and I've tried to group them by subject matter, and I'm going to paraphrase some of these. So there are several questions on the same topic, and I'll try to combine them and paraphrase. The first question, and I think that this probably is for you, General Summers, with respect to the judicial evaluation process in Tennessee, how frequently have judges in Tennessee failed to receive the 7 votes from the Judicial Evaluation Commission? That's part one. And the part two of that question is how frequently have judges failed to pass the yes, no contention vote?
The first question about judicial evaluation, I don't know. We've got 29 judges on the Intermediate Appellate Court and the Tennessee Supreme Court. So I don't know the votes, but the votes are a matter of public record. But anecdotally, I know one or two judges who have received 7 to 5 votes in their favor. I know a judge who received less than that, went back, asked for a rehearing, and was afforded a 7-5 vote in his or her favor. I do know that, as to the second question, the retention rate is about 99.3%. The only judge who was not retained was Justice Penny White in the August 1996 election, when she was not retained by a vote of, I think, 54% to 46%, and that was primarily over a death penalty case called State versus Owen.
Well, to summarize your answer, then, would it be correct to say that there has never been an occasion when the final evaluation process failed to recommend the judge for retention?
To the best of my knowledge, the Judicial Evaluation Commission has always recommended that somebody be retained.
So that would be 100%.
100%.
These questions are for Justice C. What makes the electorate more informed? A judicial commission's review that's based upon statistical analysis, or the 30-second soundbite commercial that says that a city judge is soft on crime or legislates from the bench?
And the questioner doesn't have any inclination, just like they don't know what I did.
Well, I think both. I suggest that. I have no problem with people doing reports. I think the Bar Association ought to generate that sort of information. I think the Chamber of Commerce ought to generate that information. I think other groups ought to, the trial lawyers, the other groups ought to generate that information. And typically they do during an election. It is not just a 30-second soundbite. There are mailings that go out, but there's also newspaper evaluations, editorials from around the state. And in fact, a lot of what those 30-second soundbites do is reflect what's been reported in newspapers.
The following is a multi-part question, and I will dispense with the first part of the multi-part question and just go to the second and third parts. General Summers, since all present members of the Judicial Selection Commission are appointed by Democrats, and 14 of the 17 members are required to be appointed from lists proposed by lawyer groups, and 80% of Tennessee's lawyers are Democrats, does that not make the Tennessee plan for retention elections partisan in favor of Democrats and lawyers?
I think the question premises that the Judicial Selection Commission is appointed by Democrats. Well, the Judicial Selection Commission is appointed by the Speaker of the House and the Speaker of the Senate, and the Speaker of the Senate is a Republican, and the Speaker of the House is a Democrat. What's the next one?
The Speaker of the House and the Speaker of the Senate, who was recently and terrorists instead of robbers, which is different, have to choose from lists proposed by lawyer groups. And 80% of Tennessee's lawyers are Democrats. Does that not make the Tennessee plan of retention elections partisan in favor of
Democrats? I don't know if 80% are 80% of the lawyers in Tennessee Democrats. I see a bunch of lawyers in here, I bet you're not Democrats.
Do you see any at R?
Is that your question?
You know.
There's a reason why we require the question to be specified.
I can't believe that 80% of them, our lawyers are Democrats. Maybe 80% of the trial lawyers might be, but they're not all trial lawyers. They're some like us. You know, there's some like Matt Davis over at law. Not trial lawyers. But, you're assuming, let's just say, assuming that it's 80%, you make a good point. I don't think your premise is correct. I don't think 80% of the lawyers in Tennessee are Democrats. I sure don't think that. But I know damn well the Speaker of the Senate is Republican.
I think after being 26 years the lawyers of the state Republican Party, I'm convinced that at least 80% of the lawyers.
But how do you explain that you've got three Republicans on the Tennessee Supreme Court right there?
And they're not. They all switched over and became Democrats.
The follow-up to this anonymous question. for both advocates, if the Tennessee plan for retention election of judges is good public policy, why wouldn't similar retention elections of legislators and governors and county commissioners, any other elected official, not also be good public policy?
I defer to you, Jeff.
Well, it's hard to separate those two. If we hear all this talk about, judges are different. Judges are different. School board members are different. Legislators are different from mayors. Judges are different. See, the question is the public capable of knowing the difference? If the public is, then they can require that a mayor be the kind of person that a mayor ought to be, that a legislator be the kind of person that a legislator ought to be, that a judge be the kind of person that a judge ought to be. And if the citizens cannot make that distinction, cannot understand what is different about a judge, and select judges based on that, then we got a bigger problem than whether we elect judges or appoint judges. We got a problem with a system of representative democracy that won't work because people can't handle it, can't manage it. I've seen them. I think they are capable of doing it. I think they do understand what a judge's role is, and I think they make those decisions based on whether they believe the person is going to fulfill that judicial function.
The Federalist Society did a survey recently that. The statistics were about 30% of the people had some fair understanding of how judges were elected. I believe the statistics were, might have even been less than that. I know anecdotally myself that when I was for almost eight and a half years on the Court of Criminal Appeals, I had an office in my hometown, I had an office in Jackson. When I went to my Jackson office, I would stop at the Hut. It's a restaurant. On my way to Jackson, coffee drinking buddies of mine would say, "Judge, where are you going today?" I said, "I'm going to court." They all knew I was an appellate judge. They always said, "Well, are you going to lock them up and throw away the key?" I said, "Oh, I'm sure I would." So I go to Jackson, I sit on a panel, and you might hear 12 cases. I come back to the Hut, I get a Coca-Cola, I walk in there to primarily the same guys and say, "Well, Judge, did you put a bunch of them in jail?" "Oh, yes. How many did you put in jail?" "All 12 or 14. I just told them whatever they wanted to hear, because the point is, they didn't have a clue about what I did. Now, finally, one of my coffee-drinking buddies said, "Tell me exactly what kind of judge you are." And I started to explain to him about an appellate judge and what they did, and he got so confused. And finally, I said, "You know those guys on the Supreme Court? When you see them on television and stuff and hearing the case, yeah. Well, that's kind of what I do. It's not as big a court as that, but it's kind of what I do." He had an idea then in his mind. I'm sure it wasn't exactly right. The truth of the business is people don't know. Unfortunately, it's not because of meanness. It's primarily because of lack of education, or maybe it might be lack of interest. I don't know. But unfortunately, they do not know.
It was about whether selection, the merit of selection, but also just by selecting legislators and other
candidates.
And there are a number of questions that were submitted on the same topic, following up on your comment about the removal of gender and racial bias in elections. And I'm going to have to paraphrase those questions because there are four on this very topic. Is it your point that racial and gender bias is an ineradicable inherent aspect of any contested partisan election? And if so, and if that can only be cured by a retention merit process, then why doesn't that also argue in favor of a retention merit process for legislators, governors, county commissioners?
Well, it may be something that could be explored. But I don't think it will as a practical political matter. Racial and gender bias is something that really is diluted tremendously by Wiedemeyer in the Judicial Selection Commission process, in the Judicial Evaluation Commission process. Statutorily in Tennessee, racial and gender bias is addressed in selecting the members of the Judicial Selection Commission. It intentionally, statutorily, is placed in there to give the selectors an opportunity, and it recommends that they select people who are conscious of racial, ethnic, gender, and geographical diversity. I'm not suggesting that it's perfect, but I'm suggesting that it certainly is cognizant, and certainly is statutory, and certainly is on the minds of the people who do the appointments.
My follow-up question to you is that, does the fact that the first African-American elected statewide in the state of Alabama was a member of the Alabama Supreme Court, and that this occurred in the 1970s, and the fact that in the 1970s, a female justice to the Alabama Supreme Court was elected statewide, serve as facts that would suggest that perhaps racial and gender bias is not an irrevocable inherent aspect of judicial elections, at least in the state of Alabama.
Are they still serving?
They've retired.
Well, I'm getting big. No, but they quit.
Those two both retired.
Well, I can tell you that in 1988, the first black on the Supreme Court was a Republican back in the first time. And that was George Brown from Memphis. He was selected by Lamar Alexander, who was a Republican. And 2 years later, Frank Drouota, a Democrat, beat him in a statewide contested race, and that, although Frank Drouota certainly is a great judge, has been a great judge, and is certainly my friend, there hadn't been a black on the Tennessee Supreme Court until Al Birch came on there. He was selected under the retention plan. I know anecdotally in Tennessee that it's a lot harder for a black or a minority to be elected statewide than it would be if he or she was selected on the retention plan, in my opinion.
It's time to give our advocates 5 minutes each for a closing statement, and going in reverse order from the opening statements, just to see if you would like to give your closing statement.
I had to burn you in twice. This other question.
You have 5 minutes.
Okay.
question was asked, isn't it the job of judges to protect minorities? And I think I look at the job of the judge differently, and I said, the job of the judge is to apply the law. That should protect minorities. I mean, you don't, because you disagree with it, change it for minorities, disadvantage minorities. It seems to me it's the very problem we were talking about a little while ago, this distinction between judicial activism and judicial conservatism. I think I'm being fair if I say a judicial activist is someone who believes it's the job of the judge to do what's right. The judicial conservative, someone who says it's the job of the judge to do what the law requires. I tell folks, I hope, when you make a decision about whether to vote for someone as a judge or not, whether to re-elect them or not, that you look at what they've done and you ask, not, did I like the decision, but was it a decision that followed the law? If the judge decided the way you like, it didn't follow the law, you ought to vote against it. If the judge decided in a way you don't like, but followed the law, you ought to vote for that judge and against that legislature. Because the legislature ought to be the one who are deciding what the law is or making the policy. As I said a little earlier, I think this is a question of constitutional dimension. We have judges who believe that they ought to do what's right. And they know what's right. I might agree with them. But my freedom depends on the judge applying the law, on that separation of powers, so the judges aren't autocrats. You know, we don't want all that power concentrated in a few hands. That's the reason for the separation of power. And so, I think the way you protect folks is by making sure that judges follow the law. They don't change the law depending on who the party is. And if we do that, if we did that, then we wouldn't have this problem. That's Bill Pryor's point. But, you know, more important than that, if we're going to be making these decisions, should it be a commission of lawyers who, as I mentioned, have the deficit of legal education to overcome? They've been trained that, oh no, it's a question of policy and what should you do. Should it be that group of lawyers, or should it be the public at large? Frankly, I'd be just as unhappy if it were a group of realtors. I'd be just as unhappy if it were a group of, salesmen or something like that. Because I have faith in the public. I think the public understands. Now, okay, if there's a problem, it seems to me the answer ought to be not to tell them what they want to hear, but to tell them the truth. Elections can educate. So let's tell people why they ought to vote for me. Because by golly, I'm going to apply the law. I'm not going to be making policy. But I think they understand that already. If they understand that already, then they care. They want the Constitution to be followed the way the Constitution is written. They've got to have the right to do that. They have the right to vote for judges who share their view of the Constitution. There's some fellow you may have heard of named Davy Crockett. He, you may recall, was a congressman. He went to Washington, D.C., served as congressman. While he was there, they just opened up Washington, D.C., just moved there. And there were some houses that burned down. And so Congress got together and said, you know, we need to help these folks. And they appropriated money to rebuild those houses. When it came time for re-election, Davy Crockett was out in East Tennessee. He came upon a farmer, the old farmer. Now, I don't know what the conversation was. I could picture if he was close to that rail fence, Davy probably put his foot up on that rail fence. If not, he probably walked out into the field. He said something like, I'm guessing, I've been down there, I said, my name's Davy Crockett. I'm your congressman, and I appreciate your vote for re-election. We do know what the farmer said. He said, I can't vote for it. Davy Crockett said, why not? He said, well, you remember those houses burned down? You used federal money to rebuild those houses? He said, I don't think the Constitution allows you to do that.
You can agree or disagree with that argument. You have a theory of the Constitution. It's going to hold this congressman to it. You may remember when David Crockett went to Texas, Santa Ana was the governor of the province of Texas, where they were part of Mexico at the time. Santa Ana wrote a letter in which he complained about these Americans, probably, 40% of whom were probably Tennesseans, complained about these Americans running around with a copy of the Constitution in their pockets, demanding their rights. It's the people who are responsible for the Constitution. And if we have judges who are not abiding by the Constitution as people understand it, people ought to be allowed to remove it.
General Summers, your closing argument.
Thank you.
I don't think we're different too much. What I said earlier was that judges are supposed to protect the minority when the majority is wrong. When the majority is wrong. In 2004, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce won 12 out of 13 judicial races. In 2006, nationwide business donors contributed twice as much as lawyers to judicial races. In 2004, in the Illinois Supreme Court race, which cost $9.3 million, one justice got a $350,000 from an insurance contribution from an insurance company. And after this justice was elected, sat on a case dismissing a $456 million case against that particular insurance company. And the list goes on and on and on. Judges should be independent. Judges shouldn't wear black robes. They ought to wear black and white striped robes like referees, because that's what they are. I'm not suggesting at all that, and I'm certainly not arguing at all, that just because you do not run in a partisan race, then you are going to be a judicial activist. I think anecdotally, look at Tennessee. I don't think anyone could prove a case there in Tennessee that we have a lot of judicial activism just because we have a merit selection plan. Nor do I agree with Justice Lee's argument that a popular election insulates by intimidation. Us from judicial activism. What is that? Judicial activism. That's when they rule not in my favor. That's what judicial activism is. It all depends on bad puns for Nashville and Tennessee. It all depends on who's being gold. Talking about judicial activism. It all depends on them being drawn. I suggest Chief Justice Sue Bell Cobb of Alabama got it right. She said that people need to have faith in the courts. We don't need to be raising and spending $2.6 million. Raising that kind of ridiculous money does not give us an independent judiciary. And I would also suggest that Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, retired, also got it right when she said, when we put cash in the courtrooms, it's just flat wrong. Thank you very much. I want to thank our advocates and thank once again Bolt Cummings, Congressman Berry, for their wonderful hospitality today. I would conclude as the moderator by observing that our advocates have one thing certainly in common. Justice C, as a young man, worked as a sheet metal worker and as a roofer and construction. General Summers worked in agriculture at an egg farm, was responsible for 130,000 chickens.
780,000
hens. I think that they, despite the disagreements today, I think they would both agree that what they're doing today beats the heck out of them.